back in session. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. And for our second morning session, we have one case scheduled for oral argument. And it is Ken Murphy and Scott Tornberg in his capacity as representative of the state of Deanna K. Murphy versus Ed Gutierrez. Are counsel ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I'll ask Megan Polk, our chief deputy clerk, to call the case.
May
and introduce the lawyers.
May it please the court, Mr. Jed Nesbitt, to argue for appellant, and Mr. David Ingo to argue for appellant.
Okay, Mr. Masso, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. As the clerk mentioned, I do represent the Murphys in this case. Mrs. Murphy, who passed away during the course of the litigation, is now represented by the Mr. Tornberg, but I'll refer to them just for convenience as the Murphys. This case arises from a factual basis from the design and construction of a large swimming pool. Mr. Gutierrez, the appellee in this case, was the engineer who designed the structure of the pool, and of course the Murphys, my clients, were the ones who owned it and paid for its construction. We are before the court today on the interlocutory appeal of a dismissal under Section 150.002 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which I know this court is familiar. I understand that each of your honors has actually been on a panel in the past year that's dealt with this statute. The portion of it that we're working on today is one that this court has not addressed since 2005, and it deals with, in particular, the timing of the filing of the Certificate of Merit required by 150.002. The statute certainly suggests that it should be filed at the inception of the case when a claim is made against an engineer or an architect. We state a single issue in our brief. It bears mainly on two arguments, one dealing with waiver, particularly whether Mr. Gutierrez waived his right to dismissal under 150.002, by substantially invoking the judicial process during this case before he sought dismissal, and then the second argument being whether the language of Section 150.002 actually requires dismissal in a case like this where the Certificate of Merit was promptly filed well before the dismissal was sought. I'm going to spend the bulk of my time this morning on the waiver issue. I think that's the most important one based on the case law we've seen. If there's time left or if the court has questions, I'll be glad to address the other argument, the statutory construction argument as well. Dealing with the issue of waiver, the first part that we come to, and this is something that was substantially raised in the appellee's brief, is whether waiver is actually available of the dismissal offered by Section 150.002. Importantly in that consideration is the purpose of this statute. This is something that Gutierrez and my clients agree on. It's something that this court has addressed before, that the purpose of 150.002 is to act as a screen for plaintiffs' claims against engineers and architects to determine whether there is actually any merit to them at all at the outset. It gives engineers and architects an easy way out, a quick way out, and an opportunity to avoid litigation at all. Similar to what we've seen in the MedMal context over the last years, where there's that expert report due at the inception, it allows the doctor or the hospital to escape the litigation at the outset, spending a minimal amount of money to avoid the cost of litigation on the merits altogether. Now, Gutierrez in his brief discusses that he should have a right to assert all of his defenses to the Murphys' claims in the alternative to each other without waiving them. Now, that makes sense if this were just an ordinary defense, but when we're talking about dismissal at the inception of a case, this is a little bit of a different animal and is much more akin to the expert report requirement we have in MedMal cases, to notices that have to be provided to counties, for example, before they are sued, or a motion to compel arbitration, where this is not a defense to the merits. This is not saying, I didn't do it. This is saying there's a procedural problem with your case and it cannot go any further, so I don't have to respond to you. That's what makes this different, and that's what makes it waivable when you choose to litigate the merits rather than escape litigation altogether when you have the option and the opportunity to do exactly that. Gutierrez also focuses on what he refers to as the mandatory or ministerial nature of 150.002, because it uses the word shall. It says that the court shall dismiss if the if the certificate of merit is not filed. But that's really no different than a number of the other contexts where we see requirements like this. For example, in the Med Mal context or in the notice to counties for suit, those have mandatory requirements for dismissal as well, but they likewise are waivable. And in fact, the Supreme Court has said that in essence, anything that is not of a jurisdictional nature can be waived. And we cited that. That's in the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center versus Lautzenheiser case. And that dealt with the Texas Tort Claims Act, and we've seen it also in a couple of the MedMal cases where it is something that can be waived because it's not jurisdictional, and there's not a claim in this case, and there hasn't been the argument that the certificate of merit requirement under 150.002 is a jurisdictional requirement. That being the case, it is something that can be waived, and under those circumstances, we can then look to, did Mr. Gutierrez commit sufficient acts in this case that would have waived his right to seek dismissal? So, no. There are several cases, including this court, that have discussed whether it might have been waived. None have outright said we found waiver or that definitively it can be waived. What we've seen is a number of cases who said where it was discussed, there was an argument of waiver, there was evidence of waiver. The court said, we're not going to decide today whether it can be waived or not, because we can look at the evidence and say, there was no waiver here, so it doesn't matter. And that's what happened in this court in the Palladian Buildings case, of course, from a few years back. We haven't had good enough facts yet. No case, and there have only been three or four, I believe, in the state where a waiver argument has been made in the Court of Appeals. None of them have had facts anywhere near ours to say that a waiver might have happened. And this, in that case, this is a case of first impression where we finally have facts of waiver, and the court now has to determine not only, well, do those meet the standard, and we certainly think they do, but isn't it also true then that dismissal under 150.002 can be waived? So I think we're in a somewhat unique situation here because we actually have the facts and they're in the record. That was one of the biggest problems with the Palladian Buildings case, is that there was a lot of talk about discovery and motion practice and things like that, but none of that was in the record. Because of the history of our case, it's all there.
Were all of the, you probably can't do this off the top of your head, but I'm wondering if all of the cases like Palladian that have discussed waiver but not found it predated Perry Holmes versus Cole, which involved waiver by litigation conduct of right to arbitration. And the court was, it seems to me that was kind of a landmark case on that issue, at least in the context of arbitration, and you analogized it.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I do think it was a landmark case. Off the top of my head, I think there was at least the Ustanic case, which is out of Waco, which is another one where the court evaluated the facts of waiver and decided that regardless of whether it could be waived, the facts wouldn't have gotten them there. And so I think that was a 2010 case and would have therefore come after Perry Holmes in 2008. Looking at the facts of this case, and they're detailed in our brief, I won't belabor them, but what we find here, and it's significant to note again, that the evidence that we have is in our record. One of the problems in Palladian Building and in Ustanic and the others is that the court even came out to the council and said, we hear you that you engaged in discovery. We believe you. We understand that. But if it's not in the record, we can't consider it. And what we were able to do in this case, because it did go on for 3.5 years, because we did have significant motion practice, a lot of that discovery was filed. And so there is evidence on our record of the affirmative discovery, the offensive discovery done by Mr. Gutierrez, not only to us as the plaintiffs, but also to his co-defendant, which was the contractor that built the pool, Classic Reflections pools, were depositions, written discovery, of course, expert discovery. Mr. Gutierrez hired an expert, which was deposed. Mr. Gutierrez himself was deposed. There was the affirmative contribution claim from Mr. Gutierrez to the contractor, basically the pass-through of our claims to him. And, of course, I think most importantly, a motion for summary judgment on grounds completely unrelated to 150.002, where it was a comprehensive motion for summary judgment, not just a simple no evidence or a motion for judgment on the pleadings by any means, but offered affirmative evidence of limitations and other matters. And it was granted in part. He actually succeeded on getting out of a few of our claims. What that demonstrates, though, is that there was a conscious choice at some point. The suit was filed in August of 07. Our certificate of merit was filed a couple of weeks later. The hearing that had been scheduled on Mr. Gutierrez's motion to dismiss under 150.002 was canceled. It's not in the record why it was canceled. We may never know. But it was canceled and never set for hearing again until 3.5 years later, 5 days before trial, we got notice of a new one. And so that brings us far closer to Perry Holmes, for example, than any of the other cases we've seen in any other context, including 150.002 cases, where we've looked at the facts of waiver and made a determination of, did they get to the point where they really have abandoned the right to dismissal? Because why would you, if you had this easy way out, if you have this open door to escape litigation at the outset, why spend years, why go through all of the discovery, go through motion practice, tee items up for summary judgment, actually litigate them and win some of them, prepare for trial, and then literally days before trial, suddenly we're talking about dismissal again, something that could have saved us all years of effort and a lot of money, obviously, much before.
And the second hearing, the hearing was actually set 5 days before trial?
We received notice 5 days before trial that they were going to amend the motion to dismiss and ask for a hearing. For unrelated reasons, of course not in the record, the trial was postponed, and because of that, the hearing didn't take place until March, but it was the amended motion to dismiss was filed 5 days before trial. We've talked about some of the other cases, and I would suggest for the court that the two cases that have actually discussed waiver, which are Palladian Building out of this court and Nustanik out of Waco, don't quite rise to this level. There's very little evidence in the record of those cases, and it's discussed in those opinions, of what actually went on that would support waiver. What we find in two other cases, Perry Holmes, of course, being the big one, but there's also a case called N. Ray Shepherd that's out of El Paso. It deals with a medical malpractice expert report that falls very, very similar to our facts as well. And the El Paso court in that case found that waiver did happen, where there was offensive discovery taken for some time, expert discovery, and on the eve of trial, there was an objection made to the expert report. Under those circumstances, the El Paso court found, you know, we give a lot of leeway here when it comes to dismissal, but at some point you've abandoned it. At some point, your acts are so inconsistent with claiming this right to a dismissal that we just can't allow it. It becomes profoundly too unfair. Fairness is not necessarily a part of waiver, but it is a part of latches, so I do want to talk about that for just a moment, although, of course, the factual analysis of latches is very similar to waiver. The reason why this becomes such a problem in our case, and the reason why Mr. Gutierrez's actions in this case were so incredibly prejudicial, is because during that 3.5 year lapse and during the course of all of that discovery and motion practice, the statute of limitations ran on all of the Murphys' claims, such that if they had been dismissed, whether with or without prejudice, or whether we had voluntarily non-suited them and refiled them, there is no possibility of them being raised again. And so that detriment to us, and there's a case out of the San Antonio court that we cited, the De Benavides case, that talks about detriment for purposes of a latches analysis can arise because of an inability to defend a suit that comes with the passage of time or with the activities like that. We had a
So how would there be an effect like you just discussed if the limitations were about to run in August of 07? Then the further prejudice would be there if the limitations were already to the point of running in August of 07 when the suit was filed.
Unfortunately, in our case, this is not one where there was a specific moment in time where it can easily be established when limitations began to run. We were very concerned in the fall of 07 that limitations may be about to run This is fact-intensive. It went involved in cracks showing up in a pool over the course of years. We were concerned in the fall of 07 that limitations was going to be an issue, and the longer we waited, the more likely we were going to be to fall into a trap. Had this motion to dismiss been heard in August, we might well have saved ourselves. We would have only lost a couple of weeks. However, with it not being heard for months and months and months and years, Mr. Gutierrez essentially guaranteed that there would be no chance that we could file it again, regardless.
You raised in your response to the motion to dismiss this issue about limitations running and the discussion that's in the statute itself about there being an extension of time for filing the certificate. If there is bumping up against a statute of limitations time period, was that raised in the trial court and discussed? We don't have a transcript that I saw of any hearing.
It was raised in the trial court in the response that Your Honor is speaking about. We don't have a record of the hearing because it wasn't an evidentiary hearing. It was discussed, and the trial judge's concern then was what I just mentioned, that this is sort of a fuzzy case. It was virtually impossible for us to prove, for purposes of 150.002, that the statute was going to run within 10 days. We made the allegation, but candidly, Your Honor, there was no way for us to prove it.
But you did raise that with the trial court.
We did, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weaver?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Counsel.
A couple of things have been brought up in the argument and in the briefing of the appellants in the case that I think I might want to address right off the bat. And the first one is that we talked about the purpose of Section 150.002. And counsel is correct in saying the purpose of the statute is to weed out non-meritorious claims. But it's even more so, I would offer, that the purpose of the statute is to require a party who is going to bring a lawsuit against a specific class of professionals that he must do his homework ahead of time, the same as in the medical malpractice cases. One thing that Mr. Masso indicated is whether or not dismissal was required when an affidavit was filed or the certificate of merit was filed before a defendant seeks dismissal. Well, in this case, the defendant had sought dismissal. We filed our motion to dismiss in August of 2007. The complaint that is being made here and the argument that's being made by the appellant here is that for whatever reason, the hearing on the motion was not held, and that the delay following that resulted in some kind of a waiver. And the activities involved in pursuing a defense, a vigorous defense of the claims, created or constituted a waiver. Court was correct in stating, and counsel was correct in conceding the fact that there's been no case that has ever said that waiver is applicable in this particular context. But even if it is, and the court, we do have some guidance from the courts of appeal that have considered the matter. And interestingly, the Palladian case was, I think, the first case that came up on appeal after the 2003 statute was first enacted. And from the very first time, litigants and plaintiffs have sought to avoid the requirements of this statute by alleging waiver. And they've alleged it consistently ever since. And we've had an opportunity and we've had guidance from the courts in the terms of what constitutes a waiver. And one of the big questions is it akin to waiving an arbitration clause in a contract?
And you analogized it to the medical malpractice cases where they have found that you can waive that. So what's the difference? Since the purpose of that statute versus the purpose of this statute are essentially the same.
And that's a good question because, I mean, there literally is no difference. So, maybe it can be waived. I don't know. But because there's no case that says that this particular remedy can be waived, but assuming that it is waivable, the courts have analyzed a number of factual scenarios and situations, particularly involving the invocation of the litigation process. And in Ustinic, I mean, it's interesting that counsel should bring it up because it was a case out of Waco where the petition to the Supreme Court was denied. And in that case, the defendants participated in discovery, designated expert witnesses, filed traditional and no evidence for motions for summary judgment, participated in mediation, participated in various pretrial activities, even requesting the amendment of the USINIC expert report. And the court in Waco said that that did not constitute a waiver. And in fact, what the court said was the critical question is whether or not conducting these activities were so inconsistent with exercising the right to dismissal under this section. And the court basically said that that it did not demonstrate a waiver. And it, even citing the Perry Holmes case, the court in Usinic said that, citing the examples of participating in discovery where the court did not find waiver of an arbitration clause. Attempting to learn more about the case in which a party one is a party does not demonstrate an intent to waive the right to removal. I mean, we've got two types of waiver here that we're talking about. There's an express waiver and there's implied waiver. There's no evidence of any express waiver in this case, and there's no contention, as far as I know, that the appellants are making that there was an express waiver. So the only waiver that you can get to is an implied waiver. And under implied waiver, the Supreme Court has held consistently that the conduct must be such as to evidence must be clear conduct demonstrating an intent on the part of the party against whom the waiver is claimed to have waived that right. And in this case, our intent was to defend this lawsuit. Now, when the lawsuit was filed, the court would look at the record and see the petition and pleadings that were filed. There was a whole laundry list of claims and causes of action that were filed against my client, some of which involved matters that may have been within the scope of 150-002, some of which may have not been within the scope of 150-002. And it was a decision, and our position in the case was that, first of all, the claims were non-meritorious, and secondly, that the claims were barred by the statute of limitations. I mean, it's our position the statute began to run in the middle of 2004 at the very latest. And so we elected to proceed with the discovery necessary in order to create the grounds for recovery under our motions for summary judgment. And as Justice Meyer pointed out correctly a moment ago, the issue about whether or not the plaintiffs were damaged or were somehow harmed by the delay in getting the matter heard is really rendered moot based upon their allegations and their response to our motion to dismiss. Even if they had, if it's true based on the affidavit that was attached to their response to our motion, that their cause of action accrued in mid-August of 2005, then their claims were going to be barred by limitations anyway, and it wouldn't have mattered. And there could not have been any harm. But they were on notice that we were relying upon this section as part of our defense. We never did or said anything to indicate that we were not relying on it. And it's important to note that unlike the medical malpractice statute, which after Jernigan, the legislature amended to create a deadline by which a motion to dismiss based upon an inadequate or failure to file an expert report must be filed, the legislature has not done so in this case, as the Corpus Christi court said in Landreth, the legislature has imposed deadlines when it intends to, and even though there have been some opinions by some courts to the effect that, man, we don't know if we like this statute or not, we don't know if we like the result that this statute mandates, and maybe the legislature ought to take a look at it. Well, the legislature's had a chance to look at it. It was amended in 2005 to further clarify and identify which professionals are going to be subject to it. It was further amended in 2009 to clarify and hopefully create some guidance with regard to what an affidavit must contain. And the legislature met again in 2011. And this was after the Sharp case. And this was after USINIC. And this was after all the 2010 opinions where the result was clearly what it was in the courts had said the legislature will impose deadlines when it intends to. And yet during the 2011 legislative session, there was no further amendment to this particular statute. Had the legislature intended a deadline, it could have imposed it, and it didn't. The other important thing here is that in all of these cases, we're really talking about when the motion to dismiss is filed. When do you put the plaintiff on notice that you intend to rely upon this? And on all these waiver cases, the question was, they didn't file the motion. Well, that's not the case here. We filed the motion right out of the box. We filed the motion in August of 2007, and that's in the record. The only question was whether the motion was going to be heard. And then after the summary judgment occurred, and the record would reflect, the case more or less languished, and there was no activity done. In fact, the case actually got on the court's dismissal docket for want of prosecution in early 2010. And it's our position that it's not incumbent upon us to go ahead and pursue a case that the plaintiff obviously was not pursuing. And so the passage of time occurred, not through any action on the defense part, but rather on the plaintiff's part.
Mr. Weaver?
Yes, sir.
Is it clear that the law of the case, as far as your position is concerned, is that you believe and have presented to the trial court that the purpose of this statute, the intent of the statute, was to screen claims for the people that are listed, engineers, to determine if there is a meritorious, non-frivolous claim at the time of the filing of the litigation?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's what the legislature was trying to do.
I believe that that's true, and the legislature set forth the procedure and the means by which that is to be accomplished.
And then the motion to dismiss in this case was filed at the start of the litigation, the same month in which the original petition was filed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Was there an amended motion to dismiss filed some 3 years later?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the difference in the original motion and the amended motion was only in reflecting on questions of what had transpired in time events from the time of the original filing to the time of the amended filing.
I'm not sure I understand the question,
well,
Your Honor.
I'm just saying the same reason for filing the original motion, that is, you didn't file a certificate when you filed your petition.
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
That's the same reason for dismissing it 3 years later.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so if the purpose was to screen that and determine the meritorious or non-frivolous claim, why did you wait?
Because there were, and I can explain that, and because there were other causes of action that were initially alleged that needed to be addressed. Secondly, there is the as I indicated earlier, we felt very strongly about our statute of limitations defense. And had we proceeded, say, subsequent to the motions for summary judgment, say, immediately thereafter, which occurred more than a year or a year and a half after the lawsuit was filed, was when the motions for summary judgment were heard, proceeded with a hearing, and the court, if the court were to deny that hearing, we would have had a right to an interlocutory appeal, but we would not have had a right to stay the proceedings in the trial court. So therefore, if we were going to be going to trial, then we felt like that we had grounds in addition to the grounds concerning the court's abuse of discretion had it failed to dismiss this cause of action under 150-002. We had a separate substantive ground on the basis of our statute of limitations defense. And so it was a matter of judicial economy and economy in terms of dealing with the entire case. This case would not have gone away in its entirety in September of 2007, even if the court had granted the motion to dismiss with respect to those specific claims that were covered by the statute. There were other claims that were alleged.
The reason for that might be that the plaintiff might have non-suited and refiled with the certificate.
Perhaps, and of course the plaintiff had the right to do that anyway. I mean, If I'm representing a plaintiff in a situation like this, and I look at that, and I file my lawsuit, and I don't have my certificate of merit, and then I get hit with a motion 2 weeks later to dismiss, what am I going to do? I'm going to immediately avoid all this stuff and dismiss and refile, for crying out loud, and take my chances and say if I'm right with regard to limitations in the first place, then I'm back in the game. But it's
claim dismissed as well as the claims relating to negligence.
The court found in that connection, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
There was a claim specifically for negligence and a claim for negligent misrepresentation. The other claims did not relate to negligence as I read the pleadings. Is that your understanding?
That's the way they're pled, Your Honor. And I think the court was able to look behind the pleadings to see that all of the allegations and causes of action were nothing more than a recasting of the professional negligence. And that's based on the record that's before this court as well. When the court looks and examines at what kind of conduct is being complained of, it's conduct relative to negligence in connection with the design of the swimming pool structure. And so the court looked behind that and followed the dictates of this court when it said, we're not going to be bound by the labels that are given in the allegations. We're going to look at the underlying facts and see what is really being complained of here. And that's what the trial court did. That is correct, Your Honor.
Here, isn't it?
Yes, sir. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you,
Counsel. Goodbye.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll wait for my green light. Thank you. I do just want to respond to a few of the points that Mr. Weaver raised. He mentioned at the beginning that this case is different because there was a motion filed at the outset. That motion was filed, as he said, just a couple of weeks after the case was filed. But a motion without a hearing, without a ruling from the court, doesn't preserve anything. And when it comes to waiver, we've got to look at the totality of the circumstances. Filing a motion on day one is all well and good, but when you consider that nothing is done with that motion for the next 1,200 plus days, and in from day two through day 1199, you're litigating this case full bore without regard to the fact that you've got an opportunity to have it dismissed, speaks very highly to waiver. And so it is a difference, perhaps, in some of the cases that there was a motion filed here, but it was never touched and it was never brought to the court's attention until 3.5 years later. So I think that's important to note, but it's also important to distinguish that with waiver, we've got to look at all of Mr. Gutierrez's activities and not, he doesn't suddenly preserve his right by just filing a document and letting it lie for a few years. There were. That's right. There were other causes of action, and as he mentioned later in his argument, he also said that they all arose from the profession, from the provision of professional design services. They all come under the scope of 150.002. Now, earlier this year, the TD Industries case, which Justice Meyer authored the opinion in, spoke to this, especially on the point of discovery, that when you're looking at 150.002, discovery shouldn't come into play. This is really, and he didn't use these words, but it's almost an eight corners type of analysis. Look at the pleadings. Do they arise from professional design services? If they do, you've got to have a certificate of merit. That says to me that he could have dismissed, Mr. Gutierrez could have dismissed all of these claims the minute they were filed had he pursued his motion, but he didn't. It was. I mean, we did plead causes of action other than negligence, but they all dealt with, they all arose from Mr. Gutierrez providing a faulty design that caused a swimming pool to crumble. And that's, they all arose from the same set of facts, and that was never in dispute. And that's what his initial motion said, was that this case, regardless of how artfully I pleaded it at the time, arose from the provision of the provision of engineering services. You can't get around that with artful pleading. They should all be dismissed. That's what his motion said.
But that's what you were trying to do.
Yes, that was my hope, that we might have escaped some of it. Had he simply said it for hearing, the court should, looking back now, the court probably would have granted that motion to dismiss, and we would have refiled it, and we would have dealt with the limitations issues that we had. But that's not what happened. And Mr. Gutierrez instead chose to litigate those claims for several years. The motion for summary judgment that he filed dealt with all of the same claims all over again. There was no sectioning out between, okay, these claims are subject to dismissal, so I'm not going to move for summary judgment on those. We'll deal with the dismissal later. The dismissal was comprehensive, and so was the MSJ. The MSJ was granted in part and denied in part. The limitations issues, which are the very ones he was hoping would wipe out the negligence claims, are the same ones that he lost on in the summary judgment motion. So it really doesn't help him, and it really doesn't make sense. The only thing this conduct can indicate is a choice. It's a choice to litigate the claims on the merits rather than take that easy way out. And it really leaves us with no other impression than that when the certificate of merit was filed just a couple of weeks after the suit was filed, Mr. Gutierrez looked at it and said, all right, this case has merit. The screen has been passed. Let's litigate it on the merits. That's what he did. That's what we did for 3 years. When the dismissal came, we were left in a very unfortunate position that should not be tolerated. I think the courts have a right to look at waiver under this case. I think that's why the legislature didn't act. I think they saw that the courts were considering the fact that this is something that can be waived. Waiver is always going to be a case-by-case analysis, and I think that's something the courts have to do. It's not something that the legislature can just decree and say, this is the deadline. I think if the courts are already doing their job, which they have been, they just haven't seen facts like ours yet. They haven't seen facts like this, and this is a case of waiver, and we'd like to ask this court, therefore, to reverse and remand us back to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both of you. We do. Thank both of you for your good arguments. This is a very interesting issue. Your case is submitted. Thank you very much, and you're excused.
Thank you.
And we will adjourn.
All rise.